Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Does growing up in chaos impact our nervous system as adults? That is the one question we're diving deep into answering in this episode. We're looking at early childhood dynamics and how it's expressed in our unconscious behaviors and coping mechanisms as adults. Now, I have brought in a guest for this episode who is very special to me, and it's going to be an honor to have her here. This is Dr. Tion Dayton. She actually was one that I encountered on my own journey and who taught me so much about my own inner world that I did not understand. When I first came into 12-step recovery, I came into the meetings of Al-Anon, not thinking that I belong there because I don't have that story of alcoholism in my family, but there was something that resonated with those people in that room, and her writings helped me understand why. She is a leading voice in psychodrama and a prolific author. Her books are so amazing. To be able to share some of her work today is a true honor, and I'm so excited to have her on. In this episode, you will learn the kind of coping mechanisms we develop in response to early life trauma, the importance of integrating movement and emotional expression in therapy, the importance of physical touch and intimacy in our early childhood for our development, and how a perceived sense of danger can lead to a collapse in the nervous system. And finally, what kind of environments provide the structure needed for trauma resolution? I'm so very excited for this episode. Let's get started. Where I'd love to start is really helping paint the picture for early relationships and what trauma in early relationships even looks like. I think that a lot of people don't know if they had early relationship trauma. And so what is that? And how would a person know if that's what they had?
The first place when I start to pay good attention, I think, what's the trigger? Okay, it's the chaos. Why is the chaos triggering me? And why am I feeling it in here? It's a very particular part of my body. I'm feeling this. And then I remember, because my life is not chaotic. I've been leading a pretty regular adult life most of my life, but my childhood was chaotic, and it got very chaotic as my family got smaller and smaller and smaller. And pretty soon there was no parent on board, no project manager. And I assumed that role. As a young person, I made sure I got jobs so I could earn money. I made sure I had friends if I needed friends. I made sure I got food in the house, or I figured out places to eat when I was working. I made sure I got myself to college, all without much help. And what is the offshoot of that? I don't know when I'm getting overwhelmed. I'm not managing it so well, because I'm in some level of still, I wouldn't call it denial, but throwing it out of awareness, because as soon as it happens, I really want to not get caught there. And this is a partly unconscious process. So I have to get pretty overwhelmed to register that I'm overwhelmed. And I have to work really much harder than anybody else to realize I'm working harder than anybody else. And that's childhood chaos. And that's the role I played. And it's when that role gets triggered in me today, I will still play it for too long without realizing what I'm doing. So I think that's one aspect of childhood trauma. And chaos is, by the way, a tough thing, because it's hard to pinpoint. It's hard to concretize. And generally, if you're in a chaotic environment, if you were in my family or if you were in this work situation, everyone's passing the buck. I didn't get it. I didn't see it. I did this. I can't open that. I never, you know. And in my family, the rewriting and the denial and the gaslighting was the norm. And not people not saying, yes, our life is spinning out of control. Yes, I dropped that ball. There were so many balls being dropped that I want to say there was nothing left to do but pretend you didn't drop them. Now, that was not an adult thing, but there were no adults in the room. So I, as a kid, tried to be the adult in the room.
If you're recognizing yourself in what Dr. Dayton and I are discussing, I have good news for you, my friend. For context, Dr. Dayton says about my book, The Biology of Trauma, that it brings language to experiences people struggle to name, which brings me to my good news. When you order my book now on Amazon, before its official release day on September 23, you get a toolkit of bonuses worth over $359, and I'll even send you the first three chapters to read early, including The Foreword by Gabor Mate. You will also get a masterclass that I've done on this book, plus my five-day nervous system reset with somatic self-practices that over 1,000 people have now used and said has resulted in improvements in their sleep, anxiety, digestive issues, pain, and fatigue. Now, this toolkit of bonuses, they are only available before the book comes out on September 23. So go to biologyoftrauma.com now because you will want to order it from Amazon and then put in your order information and immediately get this toolkit of gifts. And now back to Dr. Dayton. When we look at chaos, one of the aspects that I've seen a lot, and I'd love for you to speak to what you've seen over the years, is this element that the person, in this case me, maybe you, can start to feel like we're the crazy ones because we see the chaos, we see balls dropping, and yet everyone else doesn't seem to see what we see and what we're experiencing. And so that, for me at least, started to solidify my coping mechanisms of denying it as well, because the only alternative then was for me to believe that I was the crazy one. And that's not a belief that a child is going to hold on to dearly. And so it creates such an inner tension and, yeah, this kind of inner belief that maybe I am the crazy one. Maybe I'm crazy.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I realize we each have our own pattern. I feel like I'm because what my family would tell me, not that I'm the crazy one necessarily, but they would make me feel like the uptight one or the super responsible one or the, why does everything have to be just like this? Why can't you hang a little loose? That person. So I go into that thinking, oh, I'm angry and I better not be, or I'm telling everybody what to do or what they're doing wrong and I'm going to get in trouble for that. So everybody has their own little offshoot pattern. The chaos is the same. I would ask you the question is, did your family kind of tell you you were crazy or did you come to that conclusion?
I'm trying to remember if there was an actual expression of that.
Was it implicit?
Terminology. I think it was more implicit.
See, my family would have been lost in rewrite and denial and analyzing and stuff that would have made me feel crazy. But then my coping mechanism was to pull it together and to tighten up and to make sense of it and to take action. To take a lot of action, get a job, get a bank account, get a bike, get a bus pass, get whatever would get my life to move forward. So everybody is different. Everybody's different. But the chaos is not so different. The denial is not so different. The gaslighting, those things are pretty, it's interesting, right?
It's interesting in all the different ways in which it can show up. And yet at the core, it's still the same dynamic. And one of the things that you teach is around the thwarted intention, right?
Yeah.
And part of that freeze response is this thwarted intention. And so much of what I started to realize from reading your books and understanding myself was that so much of my maybe beliefs about myself, afraid of my own emotions, afraid of those, certainly those emotions that others had labeled as, oh no, we don't do that, right? Like the expression of anger, for example, we don't do that. And so when those would surface, that's when I realized that looking back that, I would have this thwarted intention and I would hold myself back based on my own experience and beliefs and shame around what I needed to do.
Can you speak to more of that thwarted intention and what that actually is?
I mean, there again, I think probably different for everyone. The reason I talk about it is because in psychodrama, we have something called an act hunger, and in trauma, we have something called a thwarted intention. One of the things that psychodrama can do is concretize issues and allow the body to move through those thwarted intentions or to express the act hunger. If you're angry, you can get angry on the stage. If you're hurt, you can curl up and cry on the stage. If you need to talk and to be direct, you can do that on the stage. If you want to put your family in roles all around the stage and stand up straight and talk to them, you can do that so that you can move through these what become blocks. I mean, thwarted intention is very much equivalent to a block or feeling stuck. So psychodrama is a very direct way of working through that. I would say those kinds of thwarted intentions are what we hold ourselves back with. And psychodrama offers a way in which to work through them. And there's usually a lot of energy release. People become more courageous. I also do something called floor checks, a sociometry, where I just ask people questions and get them moving around the group answering these. I'll put, for example, feelings on a floor, call that a feeling floor check, and just say, what feeling are you experiencing now? Walk over to that feeling, stand on it, share a sentence or two about why you chose it. So people are getting out of their chairs and moving, for one thing. They are choosing. They aren't being told what they feel. They're looking around the floor and saying, I don't really feel that, but boy, I do feel that. So that part that of trauma that is a helplessness, a collapse, gets treated throughout that process. The thwarted intention, if you have been hanging on to anger, one question might be, what feeling do you deny within yourself? What feeling do you not like feeling? Well, that is the thwarted intention you're talking about. It's a very simple way of walking over to and say, I can't let myself get angry, or if I feel lonely, I move into action or whatever. So all the processes I work with are designed to connect people with themselves, connect people with each other, allow feeling to surface, be able to name a feeling, and be able to then put it into words so you can reflect on it and think about it. But all this combining movement the whole time. It's like when you take a walk or a jog with a friend, you talk more easily because the body's in motion, the limbic system is in motion. And you would know about what I talk about is the limbic system being where we process emotion and also sense memory. I think we sort of don't understand how trauma memory works. We sort of think of memory as something that's on a ticker tape and will come back up all intact, but I don't see it that way.
And I like that expression, sense memory. Speak more to sense memory and how that may come up in a little bit chaotically at times.
Well, I think that's one of the troubles for people, particularly with serious PTSD. If there's as a smell or a sound, will trigger them into a reliving of where they were. The classic example is the soldier from Vietnam. When we learned more about PTSD, will hear a car backfire or be in a restaurant, a Chinese restaurant that has those kinds of smells, and be triggered into thinking they are back in the jungle. So those are triggered sense memories. The senses leading to a memory, a song. Who doesn't hear a song and have a flood of memories? Our senses are such an important part of adding meaning to memory. And yet they're not stored all necessarily in one neat little bundle. They're stored, well, you perhaps know a lot about this. You might want to talk about it, stored and strewn throughout the body as far as I know.
With the sense memory and early relational trauma, how does sense memory start to play into the relational trauma and how that can be triggered in times of chaos or specific situations?
Well, it can be triggered in times of closeness and intimacy also. It's people who have experienced relational trauma as children can have trouble bonding. One of the most fundamental types of bonding is between a mother and a child, a parent and a child. So much of that is just body to body. We call it now skin to skin, but it's much more than that. It's a child leaning into your body, using your body, if sucking on your body for food, leaning on your body for comfort. If you imagine a child starting as a baby being just a part of your body, and then over time, just a little more separateness. I remember when I had my daughter, I pretty much didn't put her down much for the first 6 months of her life. I was with her most of the time. And I remember when she learned to crawl at 6 or 7 months, or whatever it was, 8, 9, she suddenly looked at me and had this bright look on her face, and she took off crawling. And then she went maybe 20 feet and looked back at me. And then she looked at herself, and she looked at me, and she looked at herself, and she just kept looking back at me and herself, and she laughed. And she was, for the first time, experiencing that separateness. So what if a child does not have the holding, does not have the, that they can't choose the separateness. They can't have that burst of energy. I'm ready now to move 20 feet away from you. What if the parent is just doing all the popping down and moving away and separating? And children, if you think of babies and the need they have to attach and be held and the pain they go through when they aren't, that fundamental breach is hard to make up for when it comes to being in an intimate relationship in adulthood, because a love relationship requires that kind of touch and intimacy. Sensual relationship requires it. And parenting, you know, now no longer the child, but now the parent, requires that ability to spend sustained and intimate time with your child and to love that time, because the child knows it if you don't. So those are some of the ways they manifest. Because if you don't have that capacity physiologically, then your emotional self tends to be somewhat detached from feeling. You become heady and intellectual. And when you describe your feelings, you sound a little dissociated because you're not integrating feeling in the moment with your words.
So do you see that those younger selves of us that are in the middle of the chaos, that there is enough of a disconnection that they kind of get stuck at that stage, maybe frozen at that stage?
Well, I think Steve Porges would say your nervous system can freeze. That he talks about feeling braced for danger with those you're intimate with. It's a great way to put it, because if you don't feel your primary caregiver is with you, if you don't feel they can accept what you're feeling, then what happens to the baby? Look at Ed Tronick's work, the still-faced experiment. Just jot that down. Google the still-faced experiment. It says it all. The child will give up and stop trying to connect. And that's very fundamental. That's very fundamental. So yes, the brace for danger or the giving up can involve a freezing in the nervous system. It can involve a collapse. It can involve, how do you reconnect it then? You certainly don't reconnect it through talk therapy, unless the talk therapy is very empathic, and then you can. But a therapy that has some form of touch or movement is helpful.
And so when I think back on Ed Tronick's work, it was like looking at the collapse in real time.
Yes. And unbelievable.
Right? Unbelievable. And for me, it really struck me how early that collapse can start to get wired into the nervous system.
Yeah.
And then with repeated situations like that, which of course, if you're living in a family dynamic where there's multiple repetitions of that same type of situation, you're going to be continuing to go into that collapse over and over again. Is that a common pattern that you've seen in adult children of alcoholics?
Sure, because, or and in alcoholics. I mean, that's, you have, then you have to jumpstart your nervous system, or you have to jumpstart your sexual system, or you have to jumpstart your intimacy system, or your social system. And that's when you start to use liquor, pot, whatever you're using, food, to feel soothed and then feel less anxious, connecting.
And for me, there's so much richness and healing and even principles of healing in the 12-step groups.
Yes.
And even down to, you know, I pull a lot from that into my own programs and courses. And we start with five agreements. We don't have all 12, but we have five agreements that start to create this sense of we're all adults here. And so we are here to take care of ourselves and not someone else, and start to create that, the ground rules for how to be with people. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what we notice is that it starts to bleed into other areas of their life, not just what they're doing here with me, which is wonderful. But what are some other aspects, structure, principles, history of the 12 steps that you have found? This is why it helps someone so much with their healing journey.
Well, I do think the becoming willing, I think the surrender, the idea of surrendering to a higher power, that can be surrendering to anything that is larger than oneself. But the idea that I can't solve everything, I can't carry everything 24 hours. My nervous system can't stand it. My mind can't stand it. I have to find a place of surrendering into something higher, a meditative state, a spiritual state. I think that the spirituality of the 12-step programs is so much a part of its healing, but I love the good orderly direction that accompanies it. So it's not a belief system where you have to, people worry about that. I don't believe in God. It doesn't matter. You surrender to a higher something. And I don't think that we need to be organized. I don't even think believing in something is necessary. I think being willing to experience. I mean, from my point of view, it is a magical universe. It's hard to walk outside and see birds and not think that there is some higher force, you know, creating this beauty. I don't think it has to go beyond that in order to believe in something greater than oneself, this kind of order we live in. It wouldn't be here if I were having to get it together every day to create birds and trees and grass. So
interesting that you mentioned that specifically, because I've recently been going through more material for my book. And one of those things that has, they're calling it the new neuroscience, is this idea that when we believe that we are part of something bigger than ourselves, that our nervous system actually relaxes better into that state of both parasympathetic, but also creativity and connection, that if we're just living our life for ourselves, it becomes pretty bleak. It becomes pretty depressing and people get burned out. Whereas if the same person has the same responsibilities, but now they're doing it for a greater purpose, then that changes everything for the nervous system. And so
this is fascinating. And you know what it makes me think of? That our nervous systems are interconnected, and that our nervous systems are not only interconnected with other human beings, but with all things. I mean, therapy dogs, nervous systems are interconnected. Nature, why does nature have such a calming effect on our nervous system? It's not just human being to human being. It's human being to everything alive. And if we deny that, we're in trouble, you know? And people, if you go back to having a baby, not to recognize a child's need for being held, not to recognize that is so inhuman. I just remember with my children, I was so aware of how dependent they were on me when they were little and what a big deal it was if I was gone. I was their world when they were little. And if their world, if their mother walked away, their world walked away, you know, for a while. They braced until I returned. And then that changes eventually. That's why adolescence is adolescence.
Whole different stage of development. But yeah. In those early years, that dependence is so great. And I can even see how some mothers, that may be their trigger, is to have something that close all the time. Yeah. And so I see parenting as one of those portals into working on your own trauma.
It'll
bring so much.
It brings up everything. Being in a partnership and being a parent kicks up everything. And that's, I think then it's, you have to see it as a spiritual journey. Because if you can, then it's fodder for growth. If you can't, it's fodder for shame, blame, and projection. And there's one other thing that, this notion of taking care of ourselves, not my problem. I remember a client of mine one time sending me a quote that she thought was important. And it was something like, you can't take care of yourself and someone else at the same time. And I remember thinking, gosh, then I think I'm in trouble because I've got a family. And I showed it to my husband and I said, what do you think of this? And he said, I think if you're taking care of yourself, you are taking care of the relationship. And that after 50 years of being married and a mother and so on, it's really hard to take care of yourself, but it is taking care of the people you love and allowing them to take care of themselves in your presence. It's easier said than done. But it's a co-action. Moreno, who developed psychodrama, sociometry, and group psychotherapy, talked a lot about the co-state. And this was in turn of the century Vienna in 1890 or early 1900s. It's very much current neurobiology thinking too. The we state, all of that kind of thing.
I see that play out all the time. And now even digitally, I think it's still the same where when a group of people come together, we co-create that space.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to circle back to the 12-step meetings. We got off on the higher power.
Okay. And then, so do you want me to go through my list of why I think? It's a limbic bath. It's a limbic bath. You are in a room with people who are settling down in their nervous systems. And so the limbic resonance that is within the group is a holding that helps you re-educate how to be in your body and how to feel and talk and listen and all of those things at the same time without jumping up, acting out, yelling. The ground rules are just magical. They're wonderful. So a lot of the healing is just in the structure and the gathering of human beings respecting that structure. And I think that to have your moment to share, to have to kind of focus your thoughts, because in a good group, your time limited, and you need to organize them. And that's something, disorganized thinking is right along trauma lines. So to have to organize your thought, and for, you might spend the first year thinking, I didn't say what I meant, I didn't get enough time. But eventually, you do say what you mean, and eventually, you do feel like you've gotten the time. And then you are listening to other people without jumping up, without yelling, without acting out. There's an order, a beginning, a middle, and an end to the meeting. There's a progression in the steps that's not a goal-oriented get here, but that's a grid along which to move. And I think the preponderance of meetings and the 24/7 nature of it creates a holding environment that's absolutely necessary with trauma resolution. this notion that you can resolve trauma by going into a therapist's office and talking about it once or twice a week is really, I don't see it working. That's when I think people need to learn to tell a good story about their trauma. But when you get to know them better, you see they're still living in it. When they get triggered, they're the type that, oh, I've just got PTSD, or you've just got to understand, I just get triggered and I get to act like this. Well, they're acting like that because they have the notion that they've resolved the trauma because they understand what happened and they can talk about it. But it's not just that. It's also being able to move towards it or away from it without living in it. And when you're triggered, not to just get lost in it. And certainly justifying that it's okay to behave badly because you've been traumatized is just keeping the trauma alive and well. Does that help? And 12-step will hold you to those parameters.
There is that element of accountability. That is also a soft container. I kind of think of it as a box. It is a box. There are rules. And within that box, it's like a velvet lining, right? And so it's not harsh. It's a soft place to land, to find order, to find structure. I remember that when I was going to meetings, and I had a good meeting, I think I had the best meeting to attend. And as soon as I even just walked into the room and sat down in my chair, my nervous system settled. Like I didn't even need the meeting to start. But the order of the meeting and the fact that I could predict exactly what was going to happen. There's a beginning, a middle, and end. I know exactly what's going to happen in these. And even though every day the topic might be different, it's still the same structure. It's still the same order. And so it allowed everything else in my life to kind of depend on, no, there can be order. There can be structure. There doesn't need to be chaos everywhere. And I can start to bring order to the other areas of my life because now I have a model for how that even looks like and what it feels like in my system. Without even knowing what that felt like, how can we move towards something that we've never even experienced before? So I think one of my last questions for you will be around, you had mentioned this like movement hunger or the action hunger. Speak more to that, because I think that is so profound in our ability to, again, like move towards resolution and not just understand why we get triggered, but actually be able to complete, resolve some of these trauma responses in a way that's productive and healing.
Your question is speak to the movement, right? I think I'm speaking to the
full action hunger.
The physicalization of everything, not just the hunger for action, but for example, if somebody's been ignored, I find it easier to treat somebody who's been hit than somebody who's been neglected, because the neglect has no object. There's nobody rejecting you. There's just this vacuous place where you feel you're disappearing. So who could play the part of you that felt neglected? Who could play the neglector? How can we concretize this experience in form? Because we are beings that manifest, right? We are beings that are manifested in form. We are unbelievably vulnerable. At any moment, anything can happen. We don't go around feeling that, right? We go around kind of acting like that's not the case until something does happen. But I think the concretization for psychodrama is so much a part of its healing. When we speak in the abstract, it's just harder to wrap our minds around something. We need an object. We need that movie Wilson. Remember that? I don't remember what it was called. It was Tom Hanks. Eventually, he had a basketball. And when he lost the basketball, he lost that object of relationship. So we need something to relate to. Your question was again, tell me one more time, just because I kind of got off in my own.
No, this is great. I had started the question about the act hunger.
Yeah, it's to complete it. It's to complete it.
Be able to complete something.
Get the open tension settled. It's to get the nervous system happening again so that we're not going around braced for danger. And usually part of that is experiencing all the shaking and this part of it. And then you eventually come to some kind of nervous system closure or something. I don't know that I could explain what that is. I can see what it looks like. Sometimes it's a thought. Sometimes it's a connection. Sometimes it's an experience. But people get nervous. As part of the getting over the trauma, people's bodies shiver and shake, like Peter Levine talks about. When I work with people in psychodrama, I'll look down and their legs will be shaking. Their jaws will be, if they hit the trauma, their nervous system starts to dispel it in some way, right? But it settles.
Reminds me of what you said near the beginning, where as someone works through this, then it's like all of this energy gets unleashed.
Yes.
And you get to experience that and watch that live happen for them. And it can happen in many different ways, but it always is this some evidence of like an expansion of their energy.
Yeah. I mean, Moreno talks about catharsis, a catharsis of abreaction and a catharsis of integration, that the body needs to have some form of catharsis. And wailing walls, those tears, all these kinds of things, about some kind of an expulsion of the dance, song, music, playing instruments. There are many ways to get this energy moving.
Thank you. Again, just thank you for what you've done. I mean, just over the decades, the amount of work that you have contributed to the field. And I know that there are many more people out there like me that you have changed their life. You've helped them understand themselves. You've helped them change themselves and their patterns. And you don't even know them. And so thank you, thank you, thank you for showing up in the world in the way that you have done.
If this conversation resonated with you, if you found yourself thinking, shoot, that's me, when we talked about becoming the adult as a child or recognizing those survival patterns still running our life, well, then I know my book, The Biology of Trauma, How the Body Experiences and Holds Fear, Pain, and Overwhelm, and How to Heal, will help you finally understand what's actually happening in your body. The book releases September 23, and reminder that when you order now, before it actually comes out, I am giving you a whole toolkit of bonuses worth $359 that you can get started with now. You'll discover why your nervous system gets stuck cycling between stress and shutdown. I'll show you the 5 steps your body goes through during a trauma response. That's how I start chapter 1. And you can get the first 3 chapters now when you order the book now. Most importantly, you'll learn the essential sequences, phases for the healing journey, and how to repair even down to the cellular level. Imagine being free of those triggers, understanding why you feel this way, feel anxious or exhausted, but having the tools to do something about it. I want you to picture yourself free from the impact of your past, mind and body, and you'll become someone who knows how to support their nervous system instead of fighting against it. Whether you are dealing with chronic fatigue, autoimmune issues, or relationship challenges, or you are a practitioner and help other people have a better life, this gives you a roadmap for understanding the nervous system and nervous system healing. Again, these bonuses are only available until the book releases. So September 23, these toolkit of bonuses goes away. So if today's conversation made you think, I want to understand my body better, I want to understand why my body holds onto these survival patterns, go to biologyoftrauma.com right now and get your copy of the book from Amazon into your Amazon order information, and you will get the first 3 chapters and the other bonuses now.
And thank you for tuning into this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. If you are curious to learn more about early childhood and attachment and trauma, then I have got resources for you in the show notes. I have some related podcast episodes that I can send you to. Episode 45 is on adoption and the relationship between adoption, early childhood trauma, and bipolar. Can adoption or childhood trauma cause bipolar? Episode 48 is on healing the bracing and hypervigilance that can stay with us from childhood. Episode 58 is on parenting in a traumatizing world, the answer that our children need. That's with Dr. Gordon Neufeld. And finally, episode 73, you'll want to check that one out, where I teach on the impact of early attachment shocks. What is experienced as a shock in our early life and how unexpected stressors can cause developmental trauma and what to do. There's also YouTube videos that I can send you to. There is one that's on what you need to do first before processing your childhood trauma, a very important one to watch, and how your early relationships shape your biology. Finally, if you could please take a moment to leave a review for this Biology of Trauma podcast. As you know, I am here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help you accelerate the trauma healing journey. Your reviews and feedback are how I know how to make this better. I'm your host for this podcast. Until next episode, lots of love.